Hi friends. Just got through editing this week's episode, where I learned about the Bones to Blue bikepacking race that was held last month, August 2017, in Lake Tahoe. It's an awesome adventure, and I hope you enjoy hearing about self-supported backcountry overlanding on a bicycle. And speaking of overlanding, I've got two new stickers in the store this week. One is a cool overland sticker with mountains, and the other is a classic Overland Nevada license plate. Check them out. Also, I want to hear from you. Do you have any questions or comments for any of my guests? Anything I forgot to ask? I'd love to follow up. I also have a question for you. Since these last two episodes were about outside-the-box overlanding, what are some other things that fit the definition that we might not have thought of? Post a comment on our website, allterrainpodcast.com, or on Instagram, at allterrainpodcast, or YouTube or Facebook on the All Terrain Family channel. All right, thanks for checking in. Enjoy the show.
So yeah, you get a couple frozen burritos, you pop them in your the back of your shirt, and by, you know, 4 hours later, they're lukewarm.
Do you see your tire come all the way off the ground?
You know that guy you saw on the muddy bike? Totally loaded down with bags and gear and water bottles, miles and miles from anywhere. He may have been climbing up a long hill, barely moving, looking like he'd been out on the trail for days. Well, we're in luck. He's here. And we're going to find out just what in the hell he thinks he's doing. Hello, friends. I'm Mike. This is episode 5 of the All Terrain Podcast. And today, we're not talking about mountain biking or bike touring or bike packing. We're talking about bike packing racing. Specifically, the experience of my guest here, Matt Reynolds, in this year's Bones to Blue bikepacking race. This is a 250-mile race with 50,000 feet of climbing. It starts and ends in Truckee, California, and consists of two loops around Truckee and Lake Tahoe. Matt Reynolds is a super strong cyclist, bikepacker, old-school four-wheeler, dad and data center analyst from Truckee, California. Matt, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here. And I'm still tired from the race.
Yeah, it was the 20th, right? August 20th.
Yeah, I wrapped it up Tuesday just before midnight a week ago.
And how many days were you on the trail?
I was on the trail from Sunday at 7 a.m. till Tuesday at 11:57 p.m. So 64 hours and 57 minutes.
That's a really long time.
Yeah.
So we're gonna go through, you've listened to the podcast, we're going to go through and talk about all of the things as it relates to bikepacking and specifically this race. So for our listeners, Matt's got a lot of things to talk about, overlanding probably, and for sure, four-wheeling. So he's got a cool Commander. Jeeps or Commando, right?
Commando. 73 Commando.
73 Commando. Yeah. Sweet. So yeah, he's got pictures. I'll try and post some pictures of that. And then your dad has the Scout, right?
Well, not anymore.
Oh, no.
He just has a truck camper now, but that goes anywhere.
Cool. Well, I'll post pictures of that stuff, and we'll have you probably and your dad back on the show sometime, hopefully fairly soon. So tell me about the Bones to Blue race. Is this a new thing? I've never heard of it.
Yeah, it's bike pack racing isn't new per se. Just a little bit of history about bike pack racing. It pretty much started with the Ride the Divide, which is a race from Canada in Banff all the way to the Mexican border, all on dirt. And it's a 2,700-mile race. It was made famous in 2009 by a documentary movie called Ride the Divide. Yeah. And that, coincidentally, I saw that and I was hooked. And just like a lot of other people who saw that race and how it worked, and that just got my juices flowing. So bikepacking itself, or bikepack racing or bikepacking, is just carrying your stuff, everything you have and everything you need on the bike. So you don't have any extra support. You don't have any cars pulling up, handing you a bottle. The rules are pretty straightforward. You can use anything open to the public. You can't have any cache of gear or food somewhere. Mm-hmm. And you have to obey all the traffic laws and things like that. So it's pretty simple. And you're given a GPS route, and that's basically
it. You just follow that.
Yeah, and most of the time these races start out with a grand depart, they call it, and that's like everybody leaves the same time, and then you're just on the clock until you cross the finish line. But there's a couple dudes starting this weekend. It's called an ITT, or individual time trial. So they're starting at whatever time they want to, and then the clock starts at 6 a.m. tomorrow for them, and they're going to go, and whenever they finish, they're done.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, so. I saw some commentary on that. I wasn't sure what was going on there.
Yeah.
So Bones to Blue specifically, is that a new race?
Yeah, my friend Forrest Baker and I kind of pioneered, well, let me go back a little bit. Sean Allen kind of pioneered this route maybe 6 or 7 years ago. His route is called the California Sierra Trail Race. It started in Auburn and ended in Auburn. It was like 420 miles.
Oh, wow.
But it's a real man's route, man.
Right.
It's like, it's so insane because you start in Auburn, like 100 degree heat, and have to climb like 5,000 feet.
Is it like Western States?
Yes.
Yeah.
It uses a lot of the Western states. And so Forrest had the idea of, let's make it a little more user-friendly and get more people involved. You know, like we want people to come out and be able to do the race on a weekend, not take 7 days.
Right, right.
So that's how we kind of ended up. Let's use the beauty of Lake Tahoe, because everybody loves Lake Tahoe, and it's really cool to circumnavigate something and end up in the same place again. So if you just circumnavigate Lake Tahoe, which I've done on legal mountain bike trails, it's about 180 miles.
Mm-hmm.
But to get the real mountain bike racers interested, you got to get it in the 250 range, or they don't even want to come.
Really?
Because it takes them 100 miles to warm up, these guys.
Wow.
So that's how Forrest decided on adding the Bones Loop, which is the whole Donner Pass area that we did. And then we came back around and did the TRT around the lake. So
cool.
Yeah.
And so you finished in 60 some hours?
64 hours, 57 minutes.
And so what was the range? What was the winner?
The winner was 38 hours.
38 hours for 250 miles and 50,000 feet of climbing.
Yeah. Kurt Sandiford is his name. He's from Nevada City. And then just behind him is Isaac Chilton, who's from Auburn. Both these guys are just the top of their game. I mean, they've won other races, and basically they go as fast as they can the whole time. They didn't sleep at all in the 38 hours.
38 hours, that's reasonable, I guess.
So then there was another group of us. My friend Joe was, I think he was in the 50s. And then there's a group of us between 59 and 64 hours.
Wow.
And then there's a woman, the first woman to actually do, or first person to actually do the route, was called Alice Droba or Drobna. And she did it 2 weeks ahead because she couldn't do the Grand Depart. Wow. And she did it in 66 hours on a single speed.
Oh.
Yeah.
Is that the video that I saw?
Yes. That's
so that video is rad. So can I post that? I saw that video was private. Do you think I can post that?
Yeah.
I guess we'll ask her.
Yeah, you might want to.
If she's okay with it, I'll post the video to the or a link to it or whatever. But it's one of those 14-minute GoPro videos, and you're thinking, oh, I'm never going to watch that, but it's spectacular. It's pretty awesome.
It keeps your attention.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about what a ride like this must look like, that will be good for you to see. So, all right, well, let's get into the questions. I mean, I think, so this show has been about overlanding so far, but it never was explicitly about overlanding. And if you go by the letter of the definition, the law of overlanding, what you're talking about is overlanding.
Yeah.
So we're going to go ahead and move on, and all the same questions are going to apply. So first question is, family or friends, who's in your crew? And you can answer specifically for this race and also generally.
Okay. Well, generally, my friend Forrest, who organized the race, is in the crew. Joe Dangler is also another guy who lives up in Truckee. Blake Bacchius, who is a legend, actually.
Yeah,
in the sport. He's done a lot of racing throughout his life, and he's in his mid-50s now, and he's still kicking everybody's butt.
Oh, yeah.
But he had to pull out about two-thirds of the way through. I don't think he physically was all the way there. So he did a big race. He did a Trans-Washington race back in May. It was a 700-mile race.
Oh,
so
wow.
He's still kind of licking his wounds from that.
I guess so. I guess it'd be pretty hard to, unless you're, when your daughter gets a little older, more robust, she'll come with you.
Well, that's my plan. I mean, we went to Colorado this summer, her and I, and just did some bike touring, and I had Tapui rooftop tent
right.
and everything.
Yep.
So that was fun. But yeah, I mean, soon enough, she's going to be doing overnights with me. And, you know, bikepacking can consist of just a 5-mile biking down a gravel road and then you
right.
camp. You know, it's that
yeah.
simple. It can be as hard or as easy as you want.
Yeah, you know, we live in South Reno, and there's a guy you probably know, Jeff Moser
yeah.
in Carson City. He's done a lot of bikepacking stuff like that where they just ride over the hill to Washoe Valley and camp at the campground there.
Yeah.
Well, I could do the same thing from where I am.
Sure. I mean, we're so blessed here in Nevada and Eastern California because you can just ride any direction.
Yep. It's awesome.
Yep.
So what's your overlanding vehicle?
So I have, okay, it's sad to say, I have 3 fat bikes, and they're all my overlanding vehicles. I have 1 cross bike, which I don't ride anymore really. But so on this particular race, my overlanding vehicle was it was a fat bike with 29 plus tires and rims. So it's real lightweight.
Right.
It's a carbon frame by GSR, which is Mike Galeotto.
Oh, Galeotto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Galeotto's cycling. He designed the frame. And
it's one of those carbon ones he's been working on
yep.
the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Cool.
So I bought it from him last winter, and I rode it as a fat bike all winter, and then I converted it to 29 plus, and it's 23 pounds.
Oh.
With nothing on it.
It's a hardtail.
Yeah.
Rigid?
That was full rigid, but for this thing, I put a front suspension on it,
yeah,
100 mil of travel. So
yeah.
It was probably, without anything loaded on it, it was probably 25.
But yeah.
Then when I weighed it, it was 36 with all my gear.
Whoa.
So, yeah.
So, yeah, for our listeners, that 36 pounds is, you know, it's not a terrible weight for like a full-on mountain bike you'd expect to go ride North Star or something.
Yeah.
25 pounds is pretty light. I mean, that's almost race quality lightness for a bike. So for it to be 36 pounds fully loaded is remarkable. I mean, you wouldn't be suffering with some boat anchor.
Well, the
touring bike.
And the sad part is two of my bikes cost more than my car. The car I drove here in.
Right.
I mean, I drive a 2001 Jeep Grand Cherokee.
Right.
But still.
that's the way to
go. I mean, I spend the money where you need it, and that's, you really need it in the frame and you need it in the rims. That's
yeah.
Where
you so you got like carbon weight. Rims or something?
I have super lightweight aluminum rims.
Right.
But yeah, they're super light. And then the thing about it is you want to not go too lightweight on the tires, but if you don't, there's so much rolling resistance
right.
or loss of power. So yeah, I kind of rolled the dice and went kind of lightweight, and I did have one puncture. I had a quarter inch stick go right through the back tire.
Oh yeah.
But gosh. Just like Jeeping, I have my plugs.
Right.
So I just two plugs in there and just kept on going.
Huh.
So pretty amazing.
So we'll get to the repairs in the recovery gear section. But so tell me a little bit more about the 29 plus is like 29 by 3 inch
right.
size.
And range. That's what I, yeah. It basically, well, it's a 29-inch rim, but then the plus means the tire is larger than a normal 29-inch
right.
tire. So mine are, yeah, 29 by 3-inch tire, and they have more volume than a regular 29-inch tire.
Right.
So they're not like a fat tire. If you've seen a fat tire bike, it's lots of volume for, like, flotation on sand and snow.
Right.
But this is kind of in between. The problem with a real fat tire and all that flotation is there's so much deflection of the tire, you lose a lot of energy in that.
Oh,
so
right.
this is the good balance of that.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Okay. And then, so the next question is, how do you carry your gear? So okay. Tell us about
the bags and
the
stuff.
Bags. Yeah.
So the main,
and I'll post pictures of your setup on
sure.
the website for reference.
The main, place where I carry the gear is in the main triangle of the bike. And on the bike I had this hardtail, it has a true triangle because I didn't have rear suspension. So I can fit a big bag in there, and it had 2 compartments. So I put like all my tools, my multi-tool, spare links, tube. I run tubeless tires.
Right.
I don't know if everybody knows what tubeless tires are, but basically it's just like a car tire, but you have a sealant inside. But you have to always bring a tube, even though you have tubeless tires.
Right.
Because if you break a bead or something like that, it's real hard to set back in the wild. And I run, I have a big bottle of compressed air.
Okay.
It's larger than normal.
Yeah,
because,
like the ones that look like a little beer can.
Yeah. Well, not that big, but pretty much, yeah.
A little beer can.
Yeah, a little beer can. But that's because of the volume of the tires.
Right.
I need to have that much air to be able to pump it all the way back out.
Right.
And then I have, I do carry a pump also. So I, and then, you know, I carry one jacket. So I had my kit, which is consists of mostly wool. I like to wear wool because it doesn't smell, and it, if it's wet, it retains the heat.
Right, right.
But then I had one kind of, it's called the Patagonia Houdini. It's a real lightweight shell.
Right.
And then I had my puffy jacket, which is a Patagonia puffy. Just for
down or synthetic?
It's synthetic, so yeah. If it got wet, it's still good. I had extra pair of socks, wool. I had, I didn't bring a, I brought a sleeping kit, but I didn't bring a sleeping bag. So that this is kind of neat.
Right.
I did bring the Neolite Thermarest pad, which is the lightest pad they have. It's like a 16-ounce pad. It goes down to nothing.
Right.
So I was able to lay on that on the ground as my insulation. And then I had just the SOL bivy, which is just like the Mylar bivy.
Okay.
And I put myself in that. And I was able to, I only slept half an hour the first night, but the second night I slept 4 hours without getting cold.
So you just go like backcountry bivy style,
yeah,
and just get some shelter and
full on. And you're rolling dice because the weekend we did it, we had a lot of bad thunderstorms and weather.
Right.
So
I saw that it was probably really nice for part of it. But
it was. It's nice when it's cloudy, but yeah, I'll go into that story. But so in terms of the gear, let me think what else.
So you've got a bag in the triangle.
Oh, yeah.
You've got a bag under the seat.
I got a bag in the triangle, bag, a seat bag, which is it goes behind the seat and sticks kind of out the back of you. You'll see it on the pictures.
Right. And then, a torpedo-like or
yeah,
like a spoiler or something.
And I have, it's called a dropper bag because I run a dropper seat post. Now, if you're not a mountain biker, dropper seat post is one of the best inventions ever for downhill. There's so much control. I mean, especially if you have all these bags hanging off your bike, it's hard to get on the bike and sling your leg over. So you do the dropper and then you can easily get on the bike. So my bag is specifically made to fit the drop and still not rub on the tire.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And then I have two top tube bags. One is up by the stem, and that carries like my phone and my electronics. And then there's another little bag called the gas tank. It goes right by the under the seat, but on the top tube. And then the really cool bags are the ones that are called stem bags or feed bags, and they go on kind of each side of the stem.
Mm-hmm.
And I put a water bottle in one, and then on the other side I put all my bars and food and stuff like that. So
cool. And how much water are you taking on this? Are you wearing a Camelback as well?
No, that's one thing I've learned from the pros. Like Blake, he said,
right?
All the fast guys, they never use anything on their back because they don't want to sweat.
Right.
And they don't want to have that extra back issue.
Right.
So my first few races I had Camelbacks, and then slowly I started weaning myself off of that. But I carry probably two of the large bottles for this trip. And the reason this trip is unique is because we had so much water on the trip and it's a wet year. So all the streams that are
mid-August.
Right. Yeah. Are still running. So we were really lucky. So I do use the Sawyer squeeze.
Okay.
The squeeze.
It's that little inline filter.
Yeah. So I bring two of those and two bags in case one fails.
Okay.
They're so light.
So you fill the bag with water and then squeeze it through the filter into the water bottle.
Yep.
And those work real well.
They do. And some people try putting the inline filter in their Camelback
inline,
but apparently that doesn't work so good. So
yeah,
the best method I found is get the 1 liter ones, which are the larger ones.
Right.
And you just slowly roll it.
Huh.
So
I've wanted to build a system like that for, you know, for car camping, and bring like 2 5-gallon jugs and dip out of a river and gravity feed from one to the other.
Yeah, and you can hang the bag and it'll slowly just drip out.
Right.
I mean, it would take an hour probably to fill up,
right.
But at least you know there's no work involved.
Right, that's critical.
Yeah.
All right. So we got how do you carry gear? How do you sleep? You said you slept like just a couple times over 4 days.
Yeah, I mean, like I was saying. Kurt and Isaac slept zero, but the first night I ended up in Incline Village at like 11:30 at night at the 7-Eleven because it's the only thing open.
Right.
And I just sat there at the video poker thing and just sat there for 2 hours because I was so messed up. I got dehydrated. Right. I was dry heaving.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, I had to kind of get out of that mode. So the guy was nice enough to just let me. It was so hard I couldn't eat anything. It took me like a half an hour to eat a cup of soup because I was so
Ouch.
My stomach was so turny. But after that, yeah. So then I just continued on, and then that next night I happened to meet up with Whit, who was one of my friends, and he caught me. So we slept near the same spot together.
Did you go up Tunnel Creek Road or up to the Rim Trail?
We cut through like middle of Incline up to the old highway.
Yep. Uh-huh.
And then caught the new Tunnel Flume trail all the way across.
Incline Flume.
Incline Flume all the way over to Tunnel Creek, and then climb Tunnel a little bit more and then flume the rest of the way to Marvette.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good route. We've done that a bunch.
Yeah, I mean, we thought about going all the way up to Mount Rose and then across, but it's just kind of nice to have a spot where you can just spin it out for a while.
That
was Forrest's idea. Just have about a 20-mile section where you have beautiful lake views and you're just spinning it out.
So. That'll do it. Yeah, that is a good long rest there. All right, let's talk about food. I mean, obviously you're not doing home cooking on a trip like this.
No. But I do have some tips I've picked up along the way.
Okay.
And it will sound gross to most people, but frozen burritos are amazing.
Really?
Yes.
So you throw those in your bike bag?
Yep. So that's the thing. I mean, when you're on this trip, you can only eat food that's available to the public. So usually that's gas station food or, you know, Quickie Mart food. So what do they always have? Frozen burritos.
Frozen burritos, yeah.
But
and Pop-Tarts.
Yeah. Oh, and apple pies.
And that's apple the other. Pies.
Apple pies, it's like 400 grams of goodness.
Right, yeah.
So yeah, you get a couple frozen burritos, you pop them in the back of your shirt, and by, you know, 4 hours later, they're lukewarm.
And delicious.
And then my trick also is... they're so dry, so I always bring like some Taco Bell hot sauce with me, and then I can just
That's gourmet, man. That's awesome.
But my other trick is I always at the beginning of the race I always get a Ziploc bag of oatmeal and brown sugar and blueberries, and I just eat on that for 8 hours because it's easy on your stomach. It's easy to go down.
So you have like cooked oatmeal.
I pre-cooked it. Yeah.
Okay.
I pre-cooked it. Put it in a bag.
Right.
And then
so it's nice and sweet.
Yeah. And then I just bring a spoon with me and.
Huh.
So that got me through all the way back to Truckee that first day.
Wow.
Pretty much. And then just after you're in the race a while, it's like energy bars and gels and all that stuff that just doesn't work.
Right. Yeah.
Your stomach just gets weird. So.
It gets unappealing. It's not delicious.
You know? Yeah.
You want a Snickers bar.
You want a Snickers or you want a Pepsi. Gosh, when I'm out there, man, Coke and Pepsi is...
Yeah.
I drink it by the gallons.
Yeah. And I guess you don't take any cooking gear.
Not on the races, but I have on just regular bikepacking trips.
Right.
So I usually use backpacking food.
Right. And like a jet boil or something?
Yeah. I have a... can't remember the name of it. But I basically have a jet boil system with a titanium cup. And so...
And I'm sure you're not taking any pots and pans and utensils.
Nope,
and
just two bike bottles.
Not doing any dishes.
The only utensil is a plastic bike backpacking spoon.
Right. Yeah. All right. Here's the question.
Okay.
So you're out on the trail. You've gone through a couple frozen burritos. You've gone through some Pepsis, and it's time to make the movement.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
I don't think I'm trying to remember on this trip. I don't think I pooped.
You did.
I don't think I pooped
64 hours.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's just you're using every ounce of your energy. Anything you're putting in
is sweating it out.
Let me think. I had to have.
I mean, so obviously you're digging a cat hole, or you're gonna niche a poo in a grocery store or something.
Usually like a camp bathroom or something. But no, I remember going across Nevada last year.
Right.
And yeah, I just had a cat hole in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
But I mean, there wasn't anybody within 50 miles of me.
No. Well, there wasn't a tree too either, so it's a good thing.
Right.
But something like this, you know, I've done enough trips like this that, you know, you're thinking to yourself, oh, in 3 hours I'm going to be at 7-Eleven.
Right.
You know, and then an hour and a half, you're like, oh, emergency. So you don't make it. Or vice versa. You get 10 minutes away and you got to dig a hole in the woods.
You've done some cross-country races and stuff, right? So you know how it is. Your system just goes.
Yep. It does what it does.
But I do remember, I mean, at the beginning of the race, I had overhydrated. So in the first half an hour, I had to pee crazy. Uh-huh. And I didn't want to stop because everybody just goes.
Do you just take like a wad of TP and
I use like the baby wipes.
Okay.
Like just put them in a Ziploc. And,
right.
Yeah.
Okay.
That worked good.
All right. Any more you can say about poo?
Not really.
Okay.
No, I think.
So let's talk about recovery gear.
Oh,
obviously.
The only other thing about poo I can say is, or stinkiness in general, is I wear wool underwear.
Really?
That's key.
Do you, so, this is completely so,
no
extraneous.
Kit.
No, like, nope. chamois.
I got,
really?
The last couple of years I got out of the chamois because when I did a race across Nevada, I could not sit the last 8 hours. I was so raw.
Uh-huh.
It was just open sore action.
Yeah.
So, and that was because I learned over time that all the sweat goes into the chamois and it's all the salt crystals in there. It just starts roughing you
really?
Up.
So unless you can change that chamois, don't bring one.
Right. So a lot of people bring two chamois and wash one out and let it dry out. But I've gone to wool underwear because a chamois works for a couple hours. After that, it doesn't help.
That's true.
So
that's very true.
I just got used to it.
All right. Sorry. Well, that's more information than we need.
Yeah, TMI.
All right. So let's talk about recovery gear. Obviously, you know what we would be talking about if we were talking about 4x4s, but tell us about like tools and supplies you take to repair your bike.
Yeah, and I actually had mechanicals on this trip, so it's good. So I take a multi-tool that's got a chain breaker, which is important. And I have all the Allen wrenches in that multi-tool that fit on all the...
So like 3 to 8?
Yeah, pretty much. I think it actually goes down to 1.5, which I have a couple things that are that small. But yeah, I had to use the multi-tool, the largest setting, because my crank started binding up. And I have a race face crank, which is a 30-millimeter spindle. It's the fattest spindle you can get because it's more rigid and it's got better bearing surface. So... I had to use the huge Allen to take that thing off and back it off. We checked it out, couldn't figure out why it was binding, put it back together. It would just keep tightening itself. But there's come to find out later, you know, when you're in the heat of battle, it's hard to figure stuff out sometimes. There's a pre-tensioning part of that bottom bracket that kept spinning because of all the grit and sand and rain.
It was rubbing itself.
So it was rubbing itself tighter.
A lot of this stuff isn't necessarily designed for the crazy stuff that like this.
We're pushing it to the limit.
Right. So tools and Allen wrenches, do you carry like any grease or lubricant?
Yeah, sorry. I do carry like a White Lightning chain lube, which they say you can put on anything. So yeah.
Okay.
I was greasing my chain maybe twice a day.
Okay.
Because it gets pretty moon dusty around this time of year.
That's true.
And
so tell us about the tire repair issues.
Yeah, so I had this is the first race I've actually the last race I did last year I had the same issue where about a quarter inch size stick decided to go right through my back tire and then snap off. So I sent you a picture, maybe you can post that, but of the stick sticking out of my tire. So what I did is they have a bicycle version of the car plugs
system. I haven't actually seen that.
Yeah, so it's like a miniature version of that. And so I got all that prepped and I left the stick in, and then when I was ready to go, I pulled the stick out real quick because I don't want to have to lose all the air.
Right.
And then I put a plug in, it was still going, so I got another plug put in and it in and stopped. And then, as we were saying, I run tubeless, so there's all that sealant in the tires. I just spun the tire upside down, so
pulled up down
it pulled there. Right at the plug and just instantly sealed up. Never had another problem.
Okay. Do you carry any extra sealant with you? Like those little bitty?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you using stands or?
Yes. I use stands just because it's all I've used. But
yeah.
But yeah, I usually carry, this time I only carry 2 ounces. Sometimes I carry 5 ounces. I carry a 2 and a 3.
Right.
But yeah, I've.
Every ounce, man. It counts,
man. Sealant makes the difference.
But
it does.
You really got it. So, but if you, let's say you have an issue on this particular trip, you've got couple of bike shops that aren't too far off your route if you're there at the right time of day.
It was amazing. This Forrest and I started looking at where the bike shops and yeah, we had Backcountry and Paco's and Truckee. We had the Ski Loft in Incline.
Right.
And then in Myers, our next stop, there's a shop just like a quarter mile from where we passed. And then We didn't go into Tahoe City, but we were pretty close. You could have gone down to Olympic there.
Okay.
So yeah, there were four or five bike shops along the way. So that's why this route's pretty special.
Right.
If you did have a catastrophic failure, you could probably continue on.
You might have to wait till morning.
Yeah.
Or know somebody's phone number.
Yeah.
All right. Recovery gear. Good. Let's talk about shower or lake or onboard shower or lake. Obviously, you don't have an onboard shower and you have plenty of lakes, but I'm guessing you're not spending a whole lot of time on personal hygiene.
No, I mean, one of the big stops was Spooner Lake because it has a real nice bathroom with running water and
stuff.
So, I forgot they have one of those electric air blower things.
Oh, to like, what I don't know what you're talking about.
Hand dryer.
Hand blower, yeah. Hand dryer, right.
So I got in there. I'm like, what am I going to do with it? And I was sweaty. I'm like, okay. So I just stuck the thing down my shorts. I stuck it all over my shirt just to, you know, feel like I was getting somewhat dried out. So,
I'm sure that was sanitary.
Yeah. The next person. Sorry. But yeah, to have a running water during the trip is great. And so, yeah, just washing your face. One of the next stop after Spooner Lake is called the Fox and the Hound. It's at the top of Heavenly.
Oh, Heavenly, yeah.
Yeah. So it's just like a bar and grill, but then they have the nice bathroom stuff. So, yeah, good to freshen up there. And then Myers was the next major stop. And there was a cafe there we ate breakfast at.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's pretty much it. Squaw Valley. At the Squaw Valley, there's a 7-Eleven, and that's where our last supply was.
Oh, right, yep.
Yeah. So that was the last push into Truckee.
So it's interesting. I mean, it's pretty extreme, rough, tough conditions, you know, no nonsense. But on the other hand, you could have breakfast at a cafe in Myers.
Yeah. And obviously, Isaac and Kurt didn't do that.
No, they just plowed through.
They plowed through. I mean, this is kind of like glam bike pack racing for me. I still haven't. My friend Blake always says, I'm still fast touring. I'm not racing.
Right.
Because there's a difference. And I mean, I'll go 80%. And then if I know I need food, I'll spend an hour and a half somewhere when Blake will spend 10 minutes.
Right.
But for me, I know if I spend that hour and a half of recovery, that'll get me over the next 8 hours.
Be a lot happier.
Yeah. And I'll make it, you know, I won't burn out.
Okay.
So I'm more in the racing right now. I'm more into finishing than actually competing, I guess.
And that's a huge step, honestly.
Well, I just don't like to fail on that kind of stuff.
All right. So what, if anything, do you guys use for communication?
Oh yeah, that's real important. So you have to have a GPS. So I use a Garmin.
A dedicated GPS.
Yeah, a dedicated GPS. And I use the Garmin, I can't remember, the eTrex 30, which is kind of a big hand, not a big handheld, but it's the lightest of the handhelds. And the reason they use it is because it's battery powered. Garmin's coming along, but they still haven't found a perfect unit yet that can replace the eTrex 30, which is, I think, 5 or 6 years old.
You mean it's battery powered in that, like, consumer batteries?
Right. You can put lithiums or whatever you want in there. And if you're on a long race, I mean, I've been on the 500-mile races, I've had to replace two or three times because some of those races took me 7 days.
Huh.
So, yeah, just that's the main reason that people still use the eTrex 30. And then I always bring a backup GPS. So I have a real lightweight Garmin. Like I have a 510 Garmin, which is so if my eTrex 30 dies, I got to have something else to work.
Right.
So you can use that. And it's light, you know. And then I always have my iPhone with Gaia. You've heard of Gaia?
Yep.
Gaia is amazing. I'm sure you're...
A lot of the overlanding guys use Gaia as well.
Yeah. So I load the track on Gaia and it's so nice. I have on my stem, I have a phone mount for my iPhone.
Right.
So I can just have my iPhone right on the stem too as an option.
Okay.
So.
And how do you keep that charged up?
I use... a consumer battery backup thing. So it's got two USB holes in it, and then you charge it at home.
Right.
And then I can charge my iPhone like 6 or 7 times.
Oh, wow. That's good.
But what I'm also charging is my lights, because lights are real important. So one of my lights on the handlebars is actually AA powered, but then I use a USB headlight on my head.
Right.
So during the day, I'm charging that with a battery pack, and then And at night it's going.
Okay.
So, but a lot of other guys in the racing realm, they use a dynamo, which is a hub actually powers devices.
Right. Huh.
So it'll power your lights, it'll power your electronics, but it's finicky.
Right.
That Blake was in a race last year with me, and he couldn't continue on because that thing started breaking on him, and it wouldn't charge his GPS and his lights, so he basically had to bail.
And obviously you're not concerned about, you know, a big double light setup with 2,000 lumens of output because you're not going that fast.
I'm not going that fast, yeah. So I have a 700 lumen headlamp, but I usually only run it at like 300.
Right.
And then my handlebar light is like a 400, and I run it like a 300.
Right.
Because like you said, I'm never going over 20.
It's pretty remarkable that we can run, you know, that you can do a four-day trip like this and be self-sufficient with power.
Yeah.
I mean, with the lithium batteries and the charging, I have one of those, you know, a charger, little battery backup thing, and it's pretty incredible how it works.
It's pretty, battery technology has come a long way. It's still kind of heavy when you're just holding it, but man, to be able to charge your phone that many times and lights that many times, it's amazing.
Totally.
Yep.
All right. We're getting down to the end here.
Cool.
What non-driving activities do you do on trips like this, or non-cycling things are you doing on this trip? Are you stopping at the museums and whatnot?
Yeah. Well, my only non-cycling activity is eating.
Right.
So, I mean, that is in this kind of thing, all you think about is eating, and you have to learn how to overeat and just completely gorge yourself.
Right.
And be able to eat and then immediately ride again. So that's something a lot of people don't know how to do. I mean, if you're a racer, if you're like a road racer or something like that, they've never done that.
Right.
So you kind of have, over time, I've learned, I'm a big eater. I love eating. But you just learn to eat a lot of food because you're going to use it all for the next 8 hours straight.
And you're not necessarily hungry.
Right.
I mean, you may be half dead, but not necessarily have an appetite.
Like,
or you could be hungry and not have an appetite.
Exactly. And that's how I felt when I came into Incline Village. Like I said, I was just getting over dry heaves. I was dehydrated. I couldn't get anything down. So I just sat there for half an hour trying to eat a cup of soup.
Right.
And eventually my stomach started coming around. And then I started, you know, sausage McMuffin and all the stuff. Then I started powering it.
One thing I've found, you know, in the bike touring and endurance stuff that I've done, 24-hour races here and there, is like you said, you can get through a number of bars. We call them robot turds. A number of the bars, the cliff bars, the power bars, and whatnot. But eventually, you just sort of lose inspiration with those things. And the thing that always inspired me, the one race that I've done a bunch, is the 24 hours in the Old Pueblo.
Oh yeah.
And I'll get halfway through that race, and I'll start thinking about having a bowl of Lucky Charms, you know, and it's the one thing that gets me all the way back around.
It's just a simple can of Coke for me.
Can of Coke.
On this race especially, whenever I left a 7-Eleven or whatever, I always put a 22-ounce Coke in my back.
Right.
Just to have that. I think it's the combination of the sugar and salt.
Right. It is.
It's just such it's a great craving. And yeah, Snickers. Yeah. Those are great too. But even those, I start not liking after a while.
Right.
But yeah, any kind of yogurty thing, it always tastes good. Oh, and just for me, it's breakfast, man. When I hit that cafe in Myers, I forgot to tell you that night we spent up near Armstrong Pass, 2:30 in the morning, started raining on us.
Oh.
And I said, Whit, we got to get up. It's not going to quit. And we packed our stuff up, and it was just a deluge now for the next four hours. So we were doing, you've done Christmas Valley and all that stuff, right? It was just pouring rain, and I had my full rain gear, and I was still soaked to the core.
Ouch.
But then when we got to Myers, that cafe, and they had a redneck Benedict, which is biscuits and gravy and eggs on top with hollandaise. Oh my God. I just porked it out.
That stuff like that, man, you get so destroyed, and you have like you have a good breakfast and fried eggs, and you're like just weeping because it's wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
It's so happy.
I had 6 cups of coffee. And it was great.
Awesome. Cool. Well, you also, so we talked about your four wheeling. We don't need to talk about that some more, but you also have, so you've got that Jeep Cherokee, Jeep Grand Cherokee with a rooftop tent on it.
That's
that's an overland mobile.
Yep.
So hopefully we'll hear more about that.
Yeah. The coolest thing about that, I think I heard it on your first podcast, but one of the coolest things about that Tapui is all your bedding stays up in there. So you don't have pillows, you don't have sleeping bags, you don't have any of that stuff. So you don't realize how much room that takes inside the car.
No, totally.
But yeah, and mine sleeps 3. Okay. So it's one of the, it's the bigger of the one, and it's got the canopy that goes around the lower section. So you have a little room.
Right. Right.
And my, I have a 2-inch lift on my Cherokee, so it's just enough height so I can walk underneath the thing.
Oh.
You would hit.
I would hit
you. 5'11", so I don't.
All right.
Cool.
Well, here we are at the end of the trail. Time to take a break and gas up and make another lap. If you want to see what this trail was like, check out the website for the show notes. I'll have a video of the route. Also, we've got GPS and photos. All that stuff will go up there. My guest today is Matt Reynolds. Matt, thanks so much for coming to Reno.
Sure, Mike. It's been fun.
All right. If you've got questions or comments for me or my guests, please post a comment on the show notes on our website, allterrainpodcast.com, where you'll find any links mentioned in the show, as well as videos, trip reports, and more. You can also find us on Instagram at allterrainpodcast. Are you on Instagram, Matt?
I am, but I don't ever use it.
Oh, you should be. I like Instagram. It's all good photos. All Terrain Podcast was created, produced, engineered, edited, and managed by me, Mike Henderson. Special thanks to Chris Webster of the Archaeology Podcast Network and Colin Loretz of the Overwatch Hero Podcast. This podcast is recorded here at Reno Collective, a co-working community in Reno, Nevada. Learn more at renocollective.com.